You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up, it's this week's edition of our summer music series, Setlist. Right now, the job and the definition of a journalist has been changing in recent years, and there have been growing efforts to bring people from different backgrounds into the newsroom. Here in Wisconsin, Madison 365 is a multimedia news outlet that's geared toward Madison's communities of color. They've launched Madison 365 Academy with the Boys and Girls Club and say that they're aiming to recruit and train the next generation of journalists. They're planning on doing that by introducing and teaching young people about journalism at an important time when they're about to make decisions about their futures, senior year of high school or freshman year of college. We'll meet now two of the attendees at Madison 365 Academy, Chelsea Erstead of Madison and Sienna Mitchell of Verona. They're both teens who are in this year's Madison 365 Academy. Chelsea and Sienna, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
And Sienna, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, let's talk about this academy. First of all, Chelsea, let's start with you. Were you interested or curious about journalism before you started this?
Not really.
No? So why did you check it out?
I thought they would help me with my writing skills and maybe with any career I'd be interested in the future.
And Sienna, how about you? Had you thought about writing journalism before this?
I thought a little about it because I kind of want to be like a sports journalist. So when a teacher asked me and other students to do it, I was kind of excited.
So what kind of stuff did you do in the academy? Talk us through some of the different things, Sienna.
The first week we did like a profile, right?
Opinion
piece. Yeah, opinion piece of like on a subject we wanted to write about.
Mm-hmm.
Then the second week we did like a profile on like someone in the community that's like really important, and they picked those people for us. Mm-hmm. And then the third week we had to write about like a news local event that's been happening around Madison.
So you got to do a few different kinds of journalism.
Yeah.
And then did they edit you like somebody at a newspaper? What was the process like? You wrote your first draft, and then what happened, Chelsea?
We did peer editing, and Rob and Amber also helped us edit it. And then the day that they published, they'd go over it again and help us make any final touches before it was published.
And that's the thing. This was actually published. What was it like seeing your byline, your name in something that was actually going out to the public?
It was kind of weird because I never seen that before, but it was exciting at the same time.
So. For you too?
Yeah.
So talk about what you learned. This is a boot camp, kind of, they called it. You did a lot of work. What kind of skills did you learn? What things didn't you know that you know now, Chelsea?
Interviewing people is pretty hard for me. So I learned how to do that better.
Yeah, it's pretty hard for me, too. What did you learn about interviewing people that would help me out?
So you keep an open mind and pay attention to everything they're saying so that you could think of a question based off their words instead of trying to focus on what your angle was.
So don't just go down the list?
Yeah.
So, yeah, the worst thing is if somebody says something really interesting and you don't follow that thread, you might miss something really cool that you hadn't even thought of.
Yep.
And how about you, Sienna? What was it like for you interviewing people?
Once we started and, like, got the hang of interviewing the person, I got the flow of it. But in the beginning, it was awkward because you didn't know the person. You didn't know, like, who they were and, like, what stuff to say. So, but then after you kept doing it, it got better.
Now, in a lot of job skills outside of journalism, this is something you might have to do. Meet a new person, get to know them, whatever the field. Do you think next time around, Sienna, you'd be more comfortable?
Yes.
And how about you, Chelsea? Can you see using these skills, even if you don't end up in journalism for a career?
Yeah, they make my life easier all around.
And Chelsea, I understand your long-term plan is maybe veterinary school?
Yes.
What is it about vet school that has you interested?
I've just wanted to be a veterinarian since I was 8, so
wow.
I've been heading that direction for a long time.
And can you see you could end up being a veterinarian, but veterinarians write papers for their colleagues, or they might deal with the press in news stories, things like that. Do you think you've learned skills that would help you do that?
Oh, yeah. I've definitely got better at writing.
We're talking to two of the students, teens in the Madison 365 Academy about the skills they worked on, developed in journalism. We've got Chelsea Erstad with us and Sianna Mitchell. And Sianna, you mentioned, hey, maybe sports journalism. Now, you are active in sports yourself right now. What kind of things do you do?
I play basketball for Verona in the summer, and then I run track for Verona in the summer.
I understand track is really your main sport.
Yeah, I like track a lot.
So after doing this, are you going to look for ways to try to maybe cover sports? Obviously not the ones you're participating in, because that would be hard to pull off, but are you going to try to cover, I don't know, the school soccer game or something?
Yeah, I could possibly do that, look into that for next year.
And if you ended up covering sports, do you see yourself as, you know, print and online or broadcast, maybe ESPN someday?
Yeah, I would like to do that.
So what did you learn over the course of the academy that you think would help you become a sports journalist?
Well, I learned interviewing. That's like a big thing for like ESPN and sports journalists and stuff. And then I learned how to like write a paper in like 3 days. So that really helped me.
Yeah, that fast turnaround time is a big deal. You mentioned you both wrote opinion pieces. What, Chelsea, difference do you see in opinion writing versus, you know, the profile you did?
I think opinion writing is easier because it's more, you don't need quotes for opinion pieces necessarily, and you aren't required to interview other people. It's just what you think and basically evidence to support your ideas.
And Chelsea, did you have to, you know, do some research and find some arguments, some information, data to support your opinion? Did the editors put you through that? Or either of you,
yes.
Chelsea?
And we also had to make sure we included a counterclaim to strengthen our arguments.
Mm-hmm. Sianna, did you think that was easier than the profile and the interviewing, too?
Yeah, I think the opinion piece was easier than the profile, because for the profile, we have to record our person, and then we had to write down all the quotes, and that took a long time. And then opinion, it's just your own opinion.
Now, I want to ask you about yourselves, not as reporters here, but as consumers. Sianna, did you read the news, you know, in a paper or online much before this?
Not really. It's mostly like TV. Mm-hmm. You see the news, and then like Twitter, you see the news from there.
Now, having done this work, do you see the news that's coming to you on Twitter or on the TV a little differently now that you know the work that goes into it?
Yeah, it's a lot.
Yeah.
Yes.
And Chelsea, do you watch or read the news differently now than you've done this program?
Sometimes.
Okay. And do you think, both of you, you'll pay more attention to the news now?
Yes,
probably.
And of course, you'll listen to Wisconsin Public Radio every day, day in, day out.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay. We're going to check you on that. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
That was Chelsea Erstad and Sianna Mitchell. They're Madison area teens who are in this year's Madison 365 Academy, which is aimed at introducing young people of color to journalism. They talked to us about some of the work they've been doing as young journalists this summer. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, communicators, transporters, intergalactic travel. These are just some of the examples of science and technology popularized by Star Trek. We'll learn more about the science, especially the astronomy in the world of Star Trek. First, we continue our summer music series, Setlist. We invited artists from all over the Midwest into the WPR studios for interviews and exclusive musical performances, which are airing every Friday at this time until Labor Day weekend. You can see those performances at WPR.org/setlist. Today we feature the Milwaukee rapper Zed Kenzo. She recently stopped by to perform in our studio and talk about her songwriting process, how keeping total creative control over the production of her songs from beats to lyrics helps fend off outside influences on her music. Zed, thanks a lot for playing in the studio for us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's go back to the beginning. How did you first get into music, and when did you first get into music?
When I was a very small child. My mom put me on the piano when I was like 7. I was also in the church choir growing up, so my granny would have me and my cousin sing a lot. It was just pretty much from the beginning. And then from there, I would start writing my own songs and made them up in my head and would like make fake music groups in elementary school and stuff.
How old were you when you first started writing songs?
Probably like 7.
Wow.
The dumbest songs. Yeah. I wrote a song called like Puppy Love and it was so, so stupid.
You know,
but I was a kid, so it wasn't stupid.
I tried writing songs at older ages and they were still stupid. And I never got over that self-consciousness. How did you keep doing it?
I just kept doing it. It's just what I'm supposed to do, I think. And I know, actually.
Did you know that early 7 or so that you were a performer? That's what you wanted to do?
Yeah, definitely. My mom got me involved with dance, too. So when I was like 4 or 5, I was doing recitals, like little ballet recitals. It was pretty funny and awesome.
You're comfortable being up in front of people performing by this point, I would think.
Yes, definitely. My mom's always like, you've been on the stage since you were a kid. You'll be bleeding, use your hemoglobin for my skin serum. They be talking, tell them, shut it, they got halitosis. If I'm the prescription, you might ask for bigger doses. Freedom from its mental prison, now we call me Moses. Told you I'm the lover, compare myself to roses.
And who are you listening to through your teen years? People you look back on and enjoyed or are ashamed of, I'm guessing.
Yeah. There's a lot. Well, I mean, I grew up with R&B and like 90s hip hop. That's really been influential, and like jazz singers and Aretha Franklin and, you know, and then teenage years. Oh, I don't know, like really, I was really into like hardcore music. It's really weird. I'm definitely influenced by MIA. I kind of think I draw a little bit from that. She makes her own beats too, and it's just what comes out. Start pushing that button, and then like, I like how that sounds. I like how that sounds. Now I'm putting it together. Through my mind and fighting automatic weapons, I use them however not to my discretion. I use them however not for your protection. Unlock it and loaded my armor profession.
You're doing it, at least for your own projects, you're doing it all. How does that bounce back and forth from the beat to the lyrics and back?
I make the beat first. I have to complete that first, and then I'll just start writing over it. So far, I haven't had like, oh, I hear a sound like this. I want, you know, these are lyrics. I want to put this sound behind it. The lyrics always come after.
And the lyrics are so rhythmic, so I guess maybe that's why the beat has to be first. You know what you're playing off of.
Definitely.
Hip-hop, people could say, but you're also performing with a hardcore punk band now.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's a full official thing at this point, is it?
Yeah, I would say so. It's really, really new.
What's it like going from being a one-woman show, in effect, your own beats, your own words, your own lyrics, to another band's music, maybe someone else's lyrics?
Yeah, it's weird. I'm kind of having a hard time with that. We've done 6 songs total performing, and I memorized the lyrics to 2 songs, roughly, and the other ones I'm just kind of saying whatever I want to say. I told her, I was like, I'm going to have a hard time memorizing lyrics of someone else's, but, you know, they're really cool about it. They're like, we don't care, just do your thing and we'll get it down some other time.
As long as words happen, they're okay with that.
Yeah, I'm screaming anyway, so you can barely tell what I'm saying. It's kind of just like, meh.
Now, Milwaukee's your musical home. You'd been in L.A. for a while. Compare and contrast. What was it like being an artist there versus an artist here?
I wasn't even really an artist in L.A. I was just trying to eat food and keep the house I was in and my sanity. I was working with kids, but that's where all of my composing started. I started making my own beats when I was there. Everything was just kind of behind the scenes. I didn't do any performing or anything like that there. That all started really big in Milwaukee.
A lot of musicians go to L.A. to make it in the music industry. Was that your goal when you went there, or was that not part
sort
of the
scene? Sort of, yeah, definitely. I was there with an ex-partner, you know, and they're still doing that in L.A. So, I mean, that was definitely a factor in it, but I wasn't there long enough for any of that to actually come into fruition.
So you're back in Milwaukee, you got going on the composing and the performing. What was it like connecting with the musical scene in Milwaukee?
I'm still doing it. It's been awesome. I'm here, obviously, with Lex Allen, who drove me here, and he's pretty big in Milwaukee right now. I don't like using the word lucky, but I think I was in the right place at the right time, you know? And it's a lot of friendships and support. Everybody's really supportive of one another. I think that's why it was kind of, for me, like, oh, I can do this.
A lot of people talk about Eau Claire and the success they've had there, and that what you were saying, people being supportive of each other, mm-hmm. and collaborating, mm-hmm. and playing at each other's shows and things like that. You're mm-hmm. feeling that in Milwaukee, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's awesome. It's heartwarming. Yeah.
Do you think the rest of the state, the rest of the country does Milwaukee justice, the Milwaukee music scene?
I think it's coming along to be that, definitely. I think it's on its way to do that on a broader scale.
And you're not just performing in Milwaukee. I know you've been performing elsewhere around the country. What's on your performance list? Where are you going? Where do you want to go?
Definitely want to go to New York. Some people have reached out because I was just in Tennessee. I did a Youth Crush set, and that's the punk band. Mm-hmm. And I did a Zed Kenzo set, and people reached out from New York. So that's definitely the next move. I want to do shows in Chicago too. I mean, we had like little house shows, but I want to do some stuff at like bigger venues there, hopefully eventually. It's close. I used to live there.
Are you collaborating with other people in the Milwaukee area apart from Youth Crush? I know you've at least been in Mosaic. I watched the video earlier today. Mm-hmm. A lot of other collaborations going on.
Yeah, definitely. I'm working with Lex Allen. We have a song together right now. And I have some collaborations with another artist, Chakra Blue. She's another female MC in Milwaukee. I hate that you have to say female MC, but she's another MC in Milwaukee, Queen Tut. And I just got an up-and-coming MC also. Her name's Taj. We have some stuff together.
You mentioned you used the phrase female MC. And
I didn't mean to.
Then checked yourself on
yeah.
that. But what is it like? Is Milwaukee a friendly place for a woman in music?
I don't know if that exists anywhere. But personally for me, I've gotten good support from people. But it's always hard when you're a lady. You know, people want to just do whatever they want to do with you. You know, you got to really be like, no, this is my stuff. I'm doing this. Get back. You're not going to take over.
Does it make it easier to do that, being, at least for your solo material, a one-woman show, beats
yeah.
and lyrics?
Yeah, definitely. That's why I'm like, nope, using my own stuff. It's all me.
I understand you studied dance at UW-Madison. How does that feed into the music you perform or the way you perform it?
Definitely. I haven't been training anymore, though, and I really want to get back into actually being in a studio and pirouetting and leaping and all that fun stuff.
Is it hard to find time to do that, given that you yeah. want to put time into the music?
It's hard, definitely, but I'll get it.
With the recording and the performing and other bands and collaboration, do you have time for it all?
I do. I just need to really do it. In the winter, experiencing that again after a break from it for a year, it was really hard for me to even do music. I was really, like, at a halt.
Really? Winter shut you down?
Yeah.
Huh. I mean, if you're going to stay in Milwaukee, do you see a way you can get past that this
year? It's fine. I mean, yeah, definitely. It wasn't too bad. I mean, I still did stuff, but I just noticed that it was harder. And I think it was just my job at the time, too. Mm. It just didn't fit into my lifestyle, so it was hard to transition.
I know at least with the Youth Crush material, that's a pretty political music. Is there a political angle in a lot of your solo work, too?
Kind of. Definitely. I mean,
maybe you don't go into it thinking this
yeah.
is a political anthem
yeah,
that I'm
yeah.
writing right now.
I think in the back of my mind, it's like, I'm a black girl, and I'm here, and I'm weird, and you're going to listen to me and respect me. And like, I think it influences me in that way. She coming for your head, said Kenzo.
So where do you go for inspiration for the lyrics, for the words?
It just comes out. And I don't know. Like, sometimes I'll be in a certain mood, and I'm like, I want to write about this and make a song. But usually it's just, I'll just hear like one word and I'm like, all right, I'm going to go off of that word.
Is there a lot of like you record it and then go back, or really does it usually come out the way you started?
Yeah, it just sticks in there. Like if I write it or hear it in my head, it'll just stay like that. And I don't know. Sometimes it's different. Sometimes I'll record as I'm writing. I'll just turn it on and just start saying stuff and I'll remember it and then write it down or go back. Other times I'll just write it all in my head and then put it down somewhere on paper later.
And not much editing goes into it.
No.
It's, wow.
Just like, oh, there it is. I'm going to say that.
Does that come from being a performer since you were, you know, 5 or 7?
I don't know. I think I've just got a thing with words.
And for recording versus performing live, is there one that appeals to you more, or does it have to be some of each?
I like performing more. Recording, I get so tedious and hard on myself. I'll record the shortest song, a minute, 20 seconds long. It'll take me all day. Because I'm just like, nope, don't like how that sounds. Nope, don't like how that sounds. I'll just keep doing it over and over and over and over. It's really strenuous. I mean, I like it because I like to hear the finished product, but performing is just like, let's go. But usually I'm really exhilarated and happy afterwards. I'm just like, well, I don't even know what I just did. I blacked out. I'm good for you like B12, so be well, be immaculate.
I lurk in the back like Dracula. I'm coming. So what does success sound like for you? What are you hoping for in your musical career?
I just want to be able to travel wherever, whenever, and be welcomed and network and be able to set stuff up for other causes and other people. And I don't really have this like I want to be famous thing, but I don't know what that means either, you know. I want to be happy.
Well, thank you so much, Zed, for coming up and playing in the studio.
Thank you for having me.
That was the Milwaukee rapper Zed Kenzo. The Setlist Summer Music Series airs every Friday at this time through Labor Day weekend. Support for Setlist comes from Hyde Music. For more about the artists featured on Setlist, including songs and videos of their exclusive performances at our WPR studio, head on over to wpr.org/setlist. Coming up, we'll talk about the science behind Star Trek, new movie just out today, something like a 50th anniversary of the show. And we'll hear about the way the show has gotten a lot of people interested in exploring the universe from our vantage point here on Earth. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickard will be back with me on Monday. The newest installment in the Star Trek movie franchise is out, and the groundbreaking original TV series marks its 50th anniversary this year. For a lot of people at that time when the show came on, it was the first look at the concept of interstellar travel, alien species, mind-boggling technology. And the different incarnations of the show and the movies took us to distant stars, planets, and anomalies around the galaxy, sometimes beyond. Our next guest says Star Trek helped him get inspired to start looking at the sky, and in his new book, he uses the Star Trek franchise as kind of a window onto our universe. Andrew Fazekas joins us now. He's known as the Night Sky Guy. He's astronomy columnist with National Geographic and the author of Star Trek, the official guide to our universe, the true science behind the starship voyages. Andrew, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, good afternoon.
Well, talk a little bit about how Star Trek helped get you looking up at the stars.
Oh my gosh! Well, you know, I like to call it as the like a Vulcan mind meld of two of my passions, and that's one is astronomy and stargazing, and the other, of course, is this wonderful science fiction franchise, Star Trek, that so many love. I mean, I grew up with Star Trek, and some of my earliest recollections are of both of these things, stargazing and Star Trek, just two going hand in hand, because I remember my dad, who is a medical doctor and a researcher, always kind of encouraged me, of course, to get that inner science geek out in me, you know, making sure that I fostering that science geek in me. And we watched Star Trek back. This is back in the mid-1970s, probably one of the first reruns of the original series. And I would watch it with my dad every weekend. It would be a ritual for us. And I'd barrage him with all these questions about what Captain Kirk was up to. Where is the Enterprise? What is that planet that it's around? And question after question. And this resulted, I think my dad eventually bought a telescope. And we lived in Montreal, Canada, very light polluted city, still is today. Despite that, we would go up in our apartment building rooftop and look at the stars. We looked at the moon, the moons of Jupiter, Saturn's rings, and this just really just fueled my imagination and this love for the universe. And this has carried me on throughout. And so I always look fondly at Star Trek, always have, enjoyed all the reincarnations of all the different series over the years, and there's been 6 altogether, by the way, and 13 movies. And I've just love everything about it. And this book is really, I think, that result of that two passions coming together. It was just meant to be.
And you're trying to get other people on board, it seems like. Hey, if you like Star Trek, well, hey, look, there's this awesome galaxy out there we can check out together.
Exactly. You know, because not everyone is very familiar with the night sky. And I think a lot of people would be surprised to learn that there are a lot of real-life counterparts to objects that were pivotal in the plots of many of the episodes of Star Trek and in the movies as well. So real-life, if not the exact same objects, they're very similar objects that we can see in the night sky. And so what I'm hoping to do is get people who are not familiar with the night sky, who have never done stargazing and things like that, can go and take this book after watching an episode and step out their front door and look up and find some things just with the naked eye. Some things, maybe there's a few objects in there with binoculars or small telescopes, a little bit more challenging stuff if you like. But most of it are fairly easy objects, and it's a wide variety of types of objects that were encountered in Star Trek. So I'm hoping to engage families, you know, folks, the parents with youngsters as well, is to be able to go out, learn about science as well in the process, because there's a lot of science in Star Trek, and that's part of its charm, I think.
Well, Andrew, I love looking at the night sky. I am very bad at spatial relations. I'm basically an idiot. I can find the Big Dipper, Cassiopeia, and that's it. The moon,
yeah, you're on a good start,
the sun, if there are no clouds in the sky. So what would be a good thing, maybe from one of the Star Trek series or movies, that I could go out and maybe, if we get a clear sky, unlikely here tonight, and maybe look up and find and orient myself toward?
Well, very easy. Some of the easiest stuff is neighboring planets. Of course, we are always, when we're talking about Star Trek, the mainstay of all those adventures, of course, is the Enterprise starship visiting, going into orbit around planets, particularly what they call M-class planets. These are habitable worlds where life could possibly exist. And, of course, that's when the crew would beam down and have all their different sorts of adventures with aliens and such. But there are, planets that we can see in the sky, neighboring planets like Mars and Saturn, that are visible today in the skies. Actually, right now, over the course of the next few weeks, Mars and Saturn are particularly well placed for viewing with the naked eye. You can even be within city limits where there's a lot of light pollution, and you can see them very clearly in the southwestern sky just as darkness falls and any clear night. So even if you don't get it tonight, next few nights, anytime, you'll be able to see them. Mars looks like a very bright orange-colored star, and Saturn is actually next to it. On the left-hand side of Mars is another, as appears as a very bright yellow-colored star. And you can't miss them. They'll knock your eyes out. They're so bright in the southwest after sunset. And it's just amazing to think, you know, like Mars is a wonderful mimic almost of the type of world that Mr. Spock came from, known as Vulcan. Okay, he's a Vulcan, and he comes from a planet named Vulcan in the series. And Mars is a great analog for what type of planet, the look, at least the visual appearance of what Vulcan looked like in the series and movies. And funny enough, Gene Roddenberry actually pointed out a star in the heavens that astronomers, real-life astronomers, had been looking at as a possible home star system for a Vulcan planet. And sure enough, now astronomers have looked at this star system. It's called Eridani, 40 Eridani, and it's a visible naked eye star, visible in our winter skies. And that particular star, it seems like, may hold planets, real planets around them. Now, could one of them be a Vulcan type of planet? It is possible. We don't know yet. Our technology is not at the point of being able to make that kind of identification. But it's kind of neat to think that we could look up in the sky and see Vulcan planet analogs in the night sky.
We're talking to Andrew Fazekas. He's known as the Night Sky Guy. He's an astronomy columnist with National Geographic, looking at his new book, Star Trek, The Official Guide to Our Universe. He's talking about real-world astronomy inspired by the world of Star Trek. We want to hear from you. Are you a backyard astronomer? Do you have questions for our guest? Is there Star Trek technology you wish we had today? Were you inspired by Star Trek at some point in your life? Oh, with a love of science, astronomy, rocket science, you name it. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation in just a moment here on Central Time.
Captain's log. Stardate 1513.1. Our position, orbiting planet M113. On board the Enterprise, Mr. Spock, temporarily in command. On the planet, the ruins of an ancient and long-dead civilization.
And in the studio, Rob Ferret for Central Time. We're continuing our conversation about the science of Star Trek, what Star Trek can point us to in the night sky. We want to hear from you. Did Star Trek get you interested in science, or other science fiction for that matter? Are you a backyard astronomer? Do you have a question about what to look for in the night sky? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Andrew Fazekas is with us. His new book is Star Trek, The Official Guide to Our Universe. Andrew, there was one of those M-class planets. Now, I know you're not in this book nitpicking what Star Trek got right or wrong, but they're always visiting all these other planets. They got that right. Scientists, astronomers are discovering a ton of, what do they call them, exoplanets out there.
Exactly, exactly. And that's, I think, part of the big excitement here amongst astronomers is that what we saw in Star Trek so many decades ago, and this goes back to the inception, we're talking 50 years ago when the first episode aired, that there are other worlds beyond our solar system, planets around other stars. This was back in, it's funny, because back in 1960s, you would talk to a scientist and they'd say, yeah, probably, it just makes sense that there would be planets out there. However, would we ever be able to detect them? That seemed near impossible with the technology that we had at the time. And that's because planets, they do not emit light. They only reflect the light from their parent star, right? So when we look at all these planets, like I was mentioning before about looking at Mars in the southwestern sky in the evening and Saturn, they look like brilliant, beautiful, jewel-like shining little points of light in the sky. And that is simply because of sunlight just, you know, basically reflecting off the sand dunes of Mars, or the very reflective bright clouds and rings of Saturn. And then that reflected sunlight travels through space and we see it with our eyes. And that is how we see it. Now, what this means for anyone hunting for planets around other stars, the star light, the home star, is over a billion times more powerful in its light output than the planet's reflected light. So basically, the planet would be washed out in the brilliance of its home star, leaving us unable to pick it out of that stellar glare. However, now if we flash forward many decades later, back into the 1990s and beyond, we began to be able to pick out these planets, distant planets, because of their gravitational effect on their home stars. The stars, we had sensitive enough technology, our telescopes were so sensitive starting in the 1990s that we were able to pick out the wobble, the gravitational tug and pull that these planets would have on their home star. And from that wobble of the star, we were able to calculate out how far away these planets were, how many these stars hosted, how many planets they hosted, and how large they were. Then we added another even more exciting method of detection of planets, and that's called the transit method of actually seeing planets go in front of the star in sort of like a miniature eclipse. And as a little planet would go in front of the disk of its home star, from our line of view, that starlight would wink out a little bit, dim ever so slightly. And that little dimming effect we could use to calculate out how fast these planets orbit, how large they are. And even now we have the beginnings of being able to detect the atmospheres of these planets. So we're actually able to start hunting for the holy grail in planet hunting, which is looking for Earth 2.0, a sister Earth out there, these M-class planets that Star Trek called, these habitable worlds. It's coming to pass. It's really amazing.
Andrew, I want to check out another phenomenon, a little funkier than a planet. The Enterprise crews often spent their time in some nebula or other. I learned from your book there's a lot of different kinds of nebulae, I guess, not nebulas.
That's right. Yeah, there are many different kinds of these gas clouds, and that's what nebula really are. We're talking about these gigantic, enormous gas clouds. Could be many light years across, so much larger than our solar system. And these clouds in Star Trek, in the universe of Star Trek, they played pivotal roles in being able to allow, say, either the villain ship or the Enterprise to hide out in. In these space clouds, that's right, because the sensors would be garbled and weren't able to function in these gas clouds properly. So in real life, these nebulae are sites of the birth of stars and even the death of stars. So there's really two major kinds of nebula. So the ones that give birth or are really like star factories, and they're very beautiful in their shapes. The Hubble Space Telescope has provided some of the most beautiful imagery. Some of the picture postcards that we know from Hubble of these gas clouds are some of the more brighter ones and the ones that are closer to Earth. And a nebula like that that the Sun was born out of 5 billion years ago. So and there's clusters of these stars that are born in nebula, and they shine in a kaleidoscope of colors, beautiful tapestry of colors, because of all the electromagnetic radiation that sort of bellows out of these baby stars, and they make the surrounding gas glow like a neon sign. That's where some of the most beautiful of Hubble images have come from. And so in real life, we see a whole slew of different kinds of these clouds, and even exploding stars like supernova produce these beautiful clouds that explode outwards. And that has been even a huge part in the storyline of many different series in Star Trek, of where the Enterprise has to rush away from an impending explosion of a star.
Andrew, as we wrap up, a lot more out there in the stars we get into, but I wanted to ask, have you made it to the new movie yet, or do you have plans to this weekend?
Oh, I was fortunate enough to get a preview screening of it earlier this week. Oh, you bet I made sure I did. And I have to say, for Trek fans, it continues that legacy of the camaraderie between the crew members. I don't want to give anything away, but there is astronomy there. There's a neat planet, an M-class planet, and a nebula and an asteroid field that takes place. But there's a lot of humor, a lot of action.
Andrew, thanks a lot for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
Oh, my pleasure, and live long and prosper.
We've been talking to Andrew Fazekas. He's known as the Night Sky Guy. He's an astronomy columnist for National Geographic. He's the author of the new book, Star Trek, The Official Guide to Our Universe, The True Science Behind the Starship Voyages. This is Central Time. Yesterday, strong storms hit northern Wisconsin with nearly hurricane-force winds, causing property damage and leaving tens of thousands of people across the north without power. Joining us to give an update on the damage and the power outages up north is Danielle Kading. She's a reporter with Wisconsin Public Radio based in Superior. Danny, welcome back.
Hey, Rob. How you doing?
Okay. Better down here than up there. This is a second round of storms hitting you up there. Talk about the impact of the storm yesterday.
Well, it downed a lot of trees and power lines, leaving at least 20,000 customers from XL Energy without power. More than that, though, if you extend that into Michigan. And as I'm driving along here, looking at some of the damage on the side of the roads heading towards the city of Washburn, there are a lot of trees bent over, almost like going over the road, but crews have been working to clear that up so that people can get around.
And thousands of people, as you said, without power after the storms. Is power coming back online around the region?
You know, the last that I saw was that only 3,000 people remained without power, and that is supposed to be restored for all XL customers in Ashland, Hayward, and Ironwood today by 8 o'clock tonight.
And I understand people were feeling kind of isolated up there. Your bureau in Superior, for some people, was the only communication they had for a while. Is that right?
Yeah, and even the WPR stations were running on generators or running at low power. So, you know, lots of people up here have been going without air conditioning or fans, and so they've set up cooling centers in Red Cliff, Washburn, Ashland, and Mellon. And also people have said that, you know, some of the effects of having their power out is there's a lot of spoiled food at the school district and elsewhere. So, they're concerned about whether or not they can get reimbursement related to that storm. But since it's unrelated to the flooding that occurred on July 11th, you know, the only thing that they could potentially access is relief from the state disaster relief fund.
Right. And this is storm number two for the last couple of weeks. Cleanup still going on from that flooding damage you mentioned. How is that cleanup process going on now?
It's going to be a long-term recovery. You know, there are a lot of things that people are battling as far as road closures and access. People are struggling to get to and from work or to and from school, especially around State Highway 13, where crews in Ashland County are working with state officials to try and set up a detour on County Highway C. That should be open by early next week. Until then, they're seeing a lot of trouble with semis going on town roads, which are not equipped to handle heavy traffic. And so there's just a lot of concern about, you know, whether these roads can sustain some of the traffic that's on it now because of the damage to these main thoroughfares.
And Danny, as we wrap up, did this new storm yesterday, was this a setback for the recovery from the flooding?
Well, I think it definitely took people's attention away from the main goal. You had people who were scrambling to get generators going and to cut down trees so they wouldn't damage homes or remove them from cars and vehicles. So it was a distraction from the overall recovery effort.
Oh, and briefly, any other storms in the forecast up there? I haven't looked lately.
You know, from what I understand, there is a flood watch or something like that in effect for the area. So my hope is that moves south or somewhere else.
All right, Danny, good luck to you and everybody else up there.
Yeah, thanks, Rob.
That's Danielle Kading, reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio based in Superior. She joined us to give us an update on the damage caused in that region by the storms that hit Wisconsin yesterday.